Okay,
it
1:30.
It is now 1:03.
And?
Oh, hello. Hello, everyone. We're podcasting now. We're back in San Diego.
So we stopped talking.
So, I know.
Back in lovely San Diego.
Our professionalism has increased. The moment it starts recording, we all stop talking. We're getting good at this. But so we have escaped. We missed any tornadoes and any backlash in Oklahoma. We effectively escaped, and we're back in San Diego now in Madel's office podcasting. She has an appointment with her co-chair, the intrepid Ross Frank, in 20 minutes. Mm. So we will be blazing through a podcast right now. Madel and Angie, say hi to everybody.
Hi, Earthlings.
Madel is still wired from the coffee that she drank during our last podcast.
I can't believe that. She just did that. That's so funny. Hey, y'all.
This is radio, remember? You have to explain the hand gestures that you make to the
audience.
What
do you call Live Long and Prosper?
It's the Vulcan salute or whatever.
Yeah.
Madel is doing
Trekkies, will you please let us know what it's called? You please email. And Dustin, if you know. Would somebody leave us a comment? Because when I go to edit, it always says Angie's. Who commented Angie? So I write the blog, and then I podcast on the blog, and then I comment on the blog. I just, yeah, it's, oh
you
well.
I went to his website. It's really cool. His
blog. I will look at it.
Oh, did you put him on us? A link?
We will.
Miguel's in
mine.
Charge of that, Dustin, so if it's not up in a couple of weeks, email him directly.
I commented, I put him on my blog. I haven't put him on Voicing Indigeneity yet, though.
I wish we'd taken a picture of Dustin.
Yeah,
we should have taken more pictures in general.
I know. I brought my camera. I took 3 pictures.
The dork with the disposable camera takes 7 times more photos than you guys.
I didn't even take
the electrical
my camera.
I know. Like some bazillion-dollar camera.
Yeah, well, I don't like it when people take pictures of natives.
Oh, please. Oh, that's hilarious. But do you know what that picture of you guys with Leroy? Looks like you guys had a little white baby.
Yes.
What picture?
You guys look like a family.
She put it on the blog.
I haven't.
Oh, my goodness.
You know what? Madel's been writing her prospectus. Madel was very, I like it, I'm talking, when I do the podcast, when I'm not inarticulate, I think I sound like I'm really, you know,
Barbara Walters.
Exactly.
A radio show host or like
exactly.
The Good Morning America
mm-hmm.
type.
Good morning, Portland.
Yeah.
This is Angie.
Exactly. So what I wanted to say is that Madel has been writing her prospectus and that she was really like engaged with a lot of ideas from the conference, and she's just been really inspired by it. I personally found the conference to be really a good focus for, I did a burst of work before it, and then being there and delivering the paper and getting feedback made me realize that what I thought I was writing about and what I am writing about aren't exactly the same thing. So I've spent a few days since, you know, trying to catch up on my vegetable eating and rehydrating from muggy Oklahoma, trying to write down, you know, get the difference between those two things worked out, but that is a longer process. And so, so yeah, I'm just gonna toss this over to Madel now.
Because Madel was the most touched.
Yeah, she's pretty touched.
I don't know why.
Sometimes she touches herself.
Oh.
That was
Wait,
bad.
That could be interpreted many ways. We'll just leave it.
That.
Yeah.
We should edit it.
Right? No, just write the disclaimer.
Yeah,
just write a disclaimer that this is the PG-13 rated podcast.
Okay.
Okay, so I was really interested and inspired by the conversations that came out of the conference, particularly the way in which indigeneity was articulated. And so I've really shifted the way that I'm writing my prospectus in order to incorporate that conversation or engage that conversation. Prior to the conference, I was writing from the U.S. And talking about the ways in which Bilauans or people of Bilau are incorporated into the United States. But after the conference, I'm more interested now in situating my work in the Pacific, particularly in Micronesia, to understand the ways that the multiple subjectivities that Bilauans embody are resolved or work with each other, because I think it's kind of hypocritical of me to be thinking about how Bilauans are incorporated into the U.S. Through racial formation theories that primarily come out of ethnic studies, or do they just come out of that, or American studies?
What?
Racial formation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sociology.
And sociology. So studies. I think that, and I think it's limiting, because then in that discussion we're forgetting that Bilauans claim indigeneity to the land that we've called Belau for many years. And so it doesn't address that aspect and how that...
ever since you came over on the fish.
I was going to say something since the
complicated
ocean gave up its secrets or something.
It feels like it.
I need to give you the Maori origin myth to call your own.
No, I feel like after hearing Alice Tepunga Somerville's talk, it really changed the perspective. My perspective, because that's exactly
that. I wish I'd seen hers.
How I wanted to position my work. Not in terms of the origin story, but really how she talks about how Maori, in their origin stories, have always known that they've come from other places, right? And yet they still claim indigeneity to Aotearoa. Or the lands in which they dwell on, right? So I thought that was really interesting, because we have all these Bilauans here in the United States and across the Pacific who still find roots on the land of Belau, and yet saying that at times is very hypocritical in terms of how we deal with our own migrant foreign laborers, right? For example, on the island. So... anyway, it just opened up this new positioning for my work, and I'm actually really nervous, because this is the first time I'm confronting sort of Pacific discourse around indigeneity, and I'm terrified of the critiques that I'm gonna get from my work, but I'm also excited, because I think this is exactly the direction that I'm supposed to be taking. Anyway, that was my spiel.
Good. Yeah. Awesome.
Thank you. I just want to say that it was fun, though, right? Like, there was that awesome, short, very brief talk by at the reception.
Scott Mamaday?
Mamaday.
Oh.
I loved it. It was beautiful. He was so personal and passionate, and he's real. But, you know, a very distinguished man. I mean, he has that aura about him. I liked him a lot. Didn't meet him, but I liked him just from listening to him. Anyway.
Before I met him, I liked him.
He reminded me, though, of that guy in... Have you ever watched Star... The young guy who... Who has, never mind, I can't, Stargate? No.
What about Stargate?
Not Stargate.
Starman?
Is it Starman?
With Tell Jeff me Bridges?
With the golden pulse.
Okay, never mind.
Anyway.
The Last Starfighter?
The Last Starfighter! The Last Starfighter!
You mean the old man who recruits him?
Yeah, okay. You reminded me of him. But not in a bad way.
No, that's a funny part. I tried to rent that movie for Leroy, and this does never get back to indigeneity, so don't wonder what it connects to. But it was too scary for him.
Oh,
I know.
He doesn't like aliens.
No, he's a little worried about it.
Like, which...
a little worried about him. So,
So, Angie. Auntie was, I was just Auntie about was to getting do ready that. To hand it off to me, and
oh,
I
no,
I'm sorry.
It was.
That was pretty smooth on
my. Hey, but before I want to just thank. I think we should thank the handful of people who showed up at our panel.
You know, I've been. If you listen to this gentleman in the green shirt, he was there waiting from the very start.
Oh, the
You know, with the brown hair, and I wanted to talk to Brian Kopotic, so I didn't. But he was seemed really interested in what we were going to talk about, and I really wanted to talk to him afterwards. And he's been going through my mind ever since. I wish I had stopped.
No, I didn't check to see what his name was either. I
can't remember the college.
So there was the guy in the green shirt. There's the old man in the white shirt. There was the
Majel Boxer from Berkeley.
Hi, yes. Majel. Thank you so much. Yeah.
And then there
was Jesse.
Yeah, there's Jesse from Duke.
Duke University.
And then there was. Chihiro from Okinawa.
From University of Hawaii.
And then there was another Asian girl who left in the middle, but wasn't there at the end.
Yeah.
And then there was Brian Klopotic, Vince Diaz, and then another
Dustin.
Woman. Oh yeah, Dustin, of course.
Of course.
There was the woman who asked me about Sacrifice.
Oh yes.
I don't know her name.
No, but that's good. That's good. I'm remembering you guys.
Yeah, no, we had a handful of people.
There was a couple
people
that went in and out and stuff.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Anyway, thank you for coming, because we really appreciated having some people to share our ideas with and, you know, to be engaged with. There were a lot of great panels at that time. And.
No, next year we'll have more people. I'm committed to getting, me personally, I'm committed to bringing, like, at least 3 more people to be on panels with us next year.
Oh, to
Is
be
that
on
a
panels
dare?
With?
Yeah.
You mean, like, do multiple panels? Like, the big shots?
Yeah, like everybody else.
Well, but there are, like, they're the big guys. They're just big kids. The faculty? I don't know. Well, I'll do my best to match that, I get.
Oh, yeah. because because we're coming from another disciplinary perspective. We're coming from marginal communities. In indigenous groups and indigenous studies. And so, I mean, even if the space isn't specifically committed to us, I mean, we can still make our claims and, you know, make our demands and make our points. So, yeah.
Oh, and we need to.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really important. I think that there's a bigger audience for our ideas than was evident at the conference.
Yeah.
So
no, yeah, more people need to hear, like, because I think that, yeah, after listening to our papers, like, we presented our, what we're drawing from is very different than what everybody else is drawing from, but it's still extremely relevant to everybody, and people needed to hear stuff that was coming from that perspective, because we can't all just cite the exact same people or claim to come from the exact same space, because there is a heterogeneity of experiences and histories, etc. So yeah, we'll definitely have a Micronesian panel, which will be Madel and Vince Diaz sitting
and
in the tree.
And who else?
And
no,
perhaps Alfred.
Oh yeah, we'll have to have a Chamorro studies panel.
Yeah.
Alfred, I've already told my cousin Alfred that he's got to make it next year.
Go ahead.
Oh, cool.
Chamorros.
He's at Riverside?
Yeah, he's the one at Riverside.
See if I can't find put together a Palawan.
Yeah, try and find a Palawan in the U.S. It's not in the Navy.
Oh,
okay, that's it. It's my golden life.
It's okay. You can only find a handful of Chamorros in the U.S. that aren't in the military.
That's true.
Let me talk about my experiences at the conference.
Oh, good.
Because Angie has definitely taken out something she's working on and waving me on. See, that's how you do radio. But I wasn't sure how people would react to my paper because most people, when they come into a space like this, you know, they kind of pull away from the theoretical stuff and then say that, well, you know, we're just going to speak more real. Because these are people that understand kind of real talk. That's not so academic and stuff. But I definitely feel that That there is something to engaging and being able to twist and deform high theory or those very abstract theoretical concepts and stuff. And so I wish that more people had been there to kind of to hear what I had to say and to kind of see that, because I noticed that most people, whether by choice or because it's their work, like, weren't doing those things. Kind of most people were saying that, well, you know, there's that stuff over there, but we do our own thing over here. And so for me, it's really important to screw with those things. To, yeah, sure, you quote them and you cite them, but you also, like, you know, use them in bad and wrong ways that if the authors were alive, you know, then they would hate it.
And they're probably turning in their graves anyway.
There's something to that. I mean, I don't make any, you know, I don't, although in other spaces I would make certain claims about autonomy or sovereignty, in the academic space I make very particular claims that sovereignty is only through confrontation. And that's why my paper was about death and about suicide. It was kind of that, so if academic knowledge says that the indigenous or the native person is dead or is dying, you know, is a ghost that doesn't know it doesn't exist anymore, or a ghost that doesn't know that it can do nothing else except die, then, you know, most people say that, well, what we need to do is prove that we absolutely do exist and we are alive. And so that's fine with me, but for me I see a lot of value in basically accepting that death and kind of, instead of saying retreating from it, so if you see time and history moving forward and the indigenous person stands in that path, and as it gets closer and closer to you, you feel even more and dead, and you feel your culture and your peoplehood like slowly fading away as time touches you, like that you're supposed to retreat back or you're supposed to retreat away from it. But I see definite value in just kind of stepping through that and, you know, contesting the nature of binaries and the nature of time and stuff. So, I don't know, I look forward to doing more of that work. Basically, you know, there's very formal processes of decolonization, but then if you think about decolonization in an everyday sense, then it ultimately comes down to a lot of the statements that you make. And the way you perceive, epistemologically, culturally, politically, the way you perceive things such as time or culture, cultural divides, you know, what makes this this and what makes that that, what makes this inauthentic, what makes that authentic. And it comes down to basically how you accept, what propositions you accept, and then what you disseminate to other people. So do you, as most Chamorros say, are there not really any Chamorros left? Because our culture has changed over time, and so many speak English now, or we drive cars now, or we live in houses now. And it's like, in a space like this, that seems absurd, right, to make that distinction, that we don't live, or Chamorros aren't real anymore because we live in houses. But then so many people accept that assumption because of the way they accept anthropological frameworks, very modern frameworks for how people live. So indigenous people lived. The moment the West touched them, they died. And then now they're just, you know, they're either zombies or they're just, you know, sickly people that are waiting for Dr. Kevorkian.
So why is sovereignty only through confrontation?
No, I'm not saying it's only through that. But I definitely see that value. Because as I said in my paper, it's like, oh, Madel's passing out caffeine.
Not too much sugar, I'm off the stuff.
Because there's a point where, like, modern epistemology will give the indigenous person a space. And it'll give the racialized person a space. If you look in terms of the United States, it's a cultural space, right? You can be who you are, you can have rights, but it's always cultural rights, and it's always up to a certain point. So you can have dances, you can have songs, you can have nostalgic dreams of a homeland, but ultimately, as long as you're here, it's whiteness that rules. And so the celebration of culture does not necessarily confront that, because the celebration of yourself as this cultural thing, as a multicolored American, as a colored, you know, ethnically beautiful American, it doesn't necessarily tamper with that. So basically a lot of people of color like criticize white people for saying that, oh, I am like I reach back to my Irish roots or my German roots, and like this makes me a ethnically cultured American, like the way it does a Mexican person or a Pacific Islander person or an Asian American person. But I mean, but basically, so many people of color in the United States do the exact same thing. Your relationship to that culture, to that land, is simply just in that optional ethnic option framework, where it's like, this makes me a better American, you know, this makes me a like a little bit of a colorful American. But ultimately, the framework that I am an American in is one dominated by whiteness. I don't contest that it was white men that made this nation. I don't contest that it is white men that freed the slaves. I don't contest that it was white men that let women vote. I don't contest that it was white men that saved Europe from fascism.
Okay, but it wasn't white men who got out there and starved themselves so white women could vote. I mean, it wasn't... I'm curious about this, like, when Irish people and Scottish people and those people who are white hark back to their European roots, the reason we mock is because of because it doesn't talk about power. It doesn't address the fact, like, part of why we're always, like, looking for recognition is because we're erased, especially indigenous people, and not seen the ghost. You know, that's the only way we're relevant. So...
No, but it's that same thing. When people of color celebrate their ties to their homeland, a lot of times it isn't necessarily interested in power either. So maybe academically it might be.
But that makes a... that is actually, though, a statement of, like... I'm not saying it's, like, the most useful, but it definitely, like, means more to even say it. Contests, like, you know, hegemony. Oh, I can't believe I said hegemony. I spent, like, 9 months without saying it, so I guess it was due to come out. Well,
no,
I'm devil's advocate.
No. I mean, that's what's...
So you think I'm saying the party line here?
No, not... I mean, we're in a... I mean, it comes down to the point, is multiculturalism, has it been a good step or a bad step? Because that's what's happened. It's pushed us to this point. But it creates an even difficult hurdle to overcome. Because now it's like, well, what? You can read your stupid people's books in the university. You know, what are you complaining about? You can do your dances on the weekend. What are you complaining about?
And also, this is how I feel like... this idea of racial formation is useful in making this argument that you're making, is it also gives the space to that white person to claim their roots and then use it and deploy it as a multicultural space. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because
I have a
student who had to write an essay on racial formation and never once ever talked about people of color in this country, because he claimed Irish and German roots, and he used the theory of racial formation and the practice of racialization perfect to the T.
Yeah, in the 60s, when there was so many pushes that like created ethnic studies, for instance, the celebration of culture was, there was a lot of power to it. It contested certain things, but now, because of multiculturalism has become very dominant, It doesn't necessarily contest them. So anyways, that's what I was talking about. But I think we have to go.
No, you guys can keep talking. Oh. I'm just going over to Ross.
Well, go get him. Ask him if he wants to join us for a little discussion. We're going to talk about our projects
a little more.
I want to hear about Miguette's prospectus, especially.
I have a student coming by too.
Oh, we'll be done.
But no, we don't have to be. She'll be fine.
Okay, well, you know, we should probably only go for another 15 or so.
Okay. I'll go call Ross.
Okay, well, thanks for listening to our little housekeeping break there.
I know.
And now, I think we're definitely going
to
keep talking.
About her experience.
About my experiences at the conference. I only went to a few panels, and I found, I guess, I'm a little nervous to talk about my experiences because I was, I wish I had seen more panels because, Miguette and Madel, I think, you know, being on the margins is a pretty exciting place to be, and it can really be, like, where you hear the stuff. Like, I thought our panel was pretty neat, And I think that they told me about a couple people who I didn't see because I wasn't specifically looking for a Pacific Islander, you know, things to go to. And then also, I had a lot of work to do on my paper, so that was another reason why I missed some panels. And also, I didn't want to push my son past his limits. He was great, but you know, we had to gauge that. So I did see a few, and I saw an interesting panel with Taya Miles and Brent Klopodik, who was my McNair mentor at University of Oregon. And there was another gentleman. I don't have the thing with me. Miguel does, though. And it was talking about what is this black and Indian. And I did have to leave before Taya Miles was finished because Leroy had to go to the restroom, and it was a packed panel. But I really loved Brian's paper. I saw that he was presenting it at University of Oregon, and I asked him previously for a copy of it. And it talks about ethnic studies and indigenous studies, which is, of course, you know, what I'm interested in. It talks about methodologies and how do you focus on decolonizing methodologies when the people you're working with have racist ideas and you're committed to, you know, contesting those and social justice, yet, you know, you also feel that you need to respect the, you know, the people you're working with, and it's not your job to go in there and say, hey, what do you think is, well, you're a racist, this is wrong. So, you know, I really enjoyed his paper, and then I went to a Native Feminisms panel, and, well, one thing that was sort of humorous about that is that I realized I have no patience for literary criticism. That the social scientists they've colonized me. They've completely won me over. I used to be a fool for a nice bit of symbolism, but not anymore. I was really unimpressed. And then I got to also see Audra Simpson give a paper that I'm really interested in her work. She's at Cornell, and I have her dissertation on my desk at home, and I've finally got a paper copy. I had the ethnic studies librarian here order one so I could read it, because they kept sending me microfilm, and I that's just one more step. I always try to make things as simple as possible, because between, you know, being a single parent and a grad student, I just don't have time to find a machine. So, and her work is great, and I really, really enjoy it. I'm really interested in what she is writing about. She writes about the Mohawk Nation and recognition. I need to read more of it, because I'm writing about recognition too right now. So I just, and of course, Andy Smith is always, you know, I think she does really well when she speaks to people. I enjoy listening to her. She's smart, and I also got to see Noi Noi Silva, whose book I read last year, and I just loved it, and she was working out some ideas that she's just sort of delightful in her person, so that was cool. For me, the best part of the conference wasn't the work I saw, it was mostly the work I put into my own ideas in refining them or trying to figure out how to write my paper, and then post delivering the paper, just looking at what happened, what feedback I got, and what it is that I'm writing about, like I said earlier. So I have presented at two conferences this spring, and both times it has been like taking a huge leap forward, a great leap forward for me in my scholarship, and I've been really grateful. And each time I find being a graduate student really so humbling. You know, you get an idea, and then writing it out and working out what you think, it's excruciating. It takes a long time, and I often find that where I'm getting is in circles, and I finally feel like I'm, after a year of trying to write about what I'm writing about, and Brian Kaplatik would smile and say a year, because the paper I delivered at this conference is had a lot of themes in common with the paper I gave as my in my senior year as a McNair Scholar at University of Oregon, because really I'm always interested in the same things. I'm interested in sovereignty. I'm interested in my family's history in the 20th century. I'm interested in abuse and trauma and silences and loss and how that changes how we identify ourselves and what is Indian. So in the paper that I'm currently working on for my master's thesis, it's about, it has three main themes, termination of the Klamaths and silences and how their spaces, sovereign spaces, I think. And the last part is about sovereignty. And I think that one thing that ties those three things together is recognition. But in writing it, what will I come up with? Because right now, I honestly, it's 10 pages. So we'll see. But I keep writing in circles. I finally feel like I have I can write in circles, but I'll actually like either spiral up and hopefully not. Well, I guess I just can't leave hierarchies behind right now. I'm still tied to them. Okay, that's it for me.
Well, Madele left the room to go speak to Ross Frank, and she was supposed to snag him or kidnap him and drag him over here to join us. But she hasn't come back yet. So, the question is, do we stall for time in hopes that she will come back?
You don't want to talk about your prospectus at all? Or did you feel that you had in what you were just saying?
Oh, with my prospectus? Yeah. Oh, well, what I talked about wasn't my prospectus at all. That was just my paper. That was from... So the paper I presented at the conference was from my master's thesis that I did last year here in Ethnic Studies. And so that was all about decolonization as being suicide and tracing how the deadlock in Guam around decolonization through the metaphors of death and suicide get formed. How they're formed and how you can kind of feel them in everyday speech. And then the paper that I presented was my last chapter, which offers kind of a theory of that, of decolonization in that context. Because one thing that really frustrates me is, and I mean, there's so many reasons why this is the case, but in so many instances, kind of decolonization, people think of it in very specific, formal ways. And so in Guam, for instance, amongst the people who push for decolonization, there's only two ways that they conceive of it as. One way is a very formal process of eventually Chamorros being allowed to vote, a self-determination plebiscite, vote what happens next in terms of their political status. So decolonization in that sense, the most formal, abstract. I mean, it's not abstract, but it's just... It's basically what you find in the UN. The UN. This is the process that's guided by the UN. And then the other way is primarily cultural.
Hi, Mom.
Which is basically like that, you know what, everything that we have now is so modern. It's so colonized. It's so colonial. And so what we need to do is return to our roots. We need to decolonize ourselves and get rid of all of these Western things. Which can be productive, but can also be very, very, very problematic. But so what I try to get in people's minds is to not simply just talk about decolonization every day, but find ways of bringing process of it into the everyday. So, and then not speaking of decolonization in an abstract way, which can be used like at every point. So, for example, like the idea that decolonization is cultural, that's something that you're supposed to. It's a framework that says that, well, colonization started at this point. Everything that came in after that is part of colonialism. So therefore, decolonization is reaching back to whatever happened before that point. And that, like, that's pretty ridiculous. I mean, it's just not a good idea in any way, shape, or form. It's incredibly disrespectful to those that survived colonization. It's incredibly, like, it's just this frustrating way a feeling that you have agency and sovereignty while the gaze of the colonizer dictates your every move. Because that's
good stuff, man.
Because that's the way it is. The colonizer says that all you have is just cultural practices. And so that's what you do. You enjoy that position and you get excited about it, and it's great, but it's not decolonization. Because decolonization means confronting that very divide. It's confronting that point in time. It's not accepting that some historian wrote of you and established the parameters for your existence. Like, Angie had a good quote in her paper, which is just a very regular way of talking about that, about how sovereignty is about, you know, basically deciding on how you will exist, what you need to do for a community to survive, to exist. And it's like, that's just a very simple point, but we need to take that into account in so many different ways. So for me, decolonization is all about context. It's all about what is it that you're contesting? What is it that you're trying to decolonize? So for me, I wanted to decolonize the resistance to decolonization in Guam. And so I provided a theory from that, basically what are the images that come out? So when people speak of colonization and when they resist it, like, what are the metaphors? What's the language? What's the images that they use to resist it or to say it's wrong, to say it's bad, to say it's stupid? Well, they basically say it's suicide. And so that's what I did. I said, well, so this is the point. So instead of saying that decolonization is not suicide, let's explore it and say that it absolutely is. And what do we find? And what I found was that, yes, decolonization has to be suicide. There has to be this dimension in which you can let go of something which seems very core and central to you right now. You know, this idea that I can't contest the Americanness of the island or myself. It's just too much. What will happen after I do that? Well, that's precisely what you have to do, and you can't shun away from that and retreat into the times before colonization. So I've talked for five minutes and Madel's still not here.
Okay, and Miguel's gonna go visit his family, so he wants to get on the road, and my son is homesick from school today, which means that I had to bring him up here to podcast.
Hi!
Well, luckily he's not super sick. Yeah. So we're gonna go, and thank you so much for listening. I hope that, that was inspiring. Miguel's quite the philosopher. It's really interesting. I honestly, I learn so much from listening to him. So let's just do it till next time. We'll try and get together and do another one next week. And look for Miguel's paper on the web.
No, yeah, paper? We'll be putting our papers up in some shape or form.
All right.
People, even if we read them and record them and people can download them. But this is a really good blog. Podcast, like, people actually are listening. I think we get about 25 to 30 hits a day.
That's really exciting.
Which is good, considering that it's just the three of us that are doing this and so on. So,
because we insist upon it.
it's good. All our brains are much mushier and more fluid because of this. We're not turning into, like, hard-brained people. It's
That's
mushy.
That's true. I often have to let go of my dearest ideas. Oh, man.
But so thank you so much for listening. If you have any comments or questions or problems, you can email mlbasquiat@hotmail.com. Okay.
Happy Mother's Day. Shout out to all the moms out there.
Happy Mother's Day to all the mothers in my life.
Bye, everyone.
I'm sorry I forget about you sometimes.
All right.